Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center presents Doc Talk, an informative health series educating our community on the services provided at Peace Health. We will begin with our host, George Henry, after these messages.
At some point in her life, one out of every eight women will get breast cancer. One out of eight. Most women can beat it, but only with early detection. Don't let breast cancer stop you. Mammograms save lives.
Better total care. Peace Harbor Imaging now has digital mammograms. Get one.
During uncertain times, the best way to stay healthy is to know the facts. Here are some ways we all can help stop the spread of COVID-19. Only leave your home for necessities. Wash your hands for at least 20 seconds. Call your doctor before going to the clinic or hospital if you're experiencing COVID-19 symptoms. At Peace Health, the safety and well-being of our patients, caregivers, and communities is our highest priority. We are all in this together. For more information, log on to peacehealth.org/COVID.
Dr. Stuart Weber has joined the neurology team at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center at River Bend, and he's joining us now for Doc Talk for the month of May. Dr. Weber, good day to you. How are you doing?
Hey, George. Doing pretty good today.
Awesome. Now, normally when we do a Doc Talk, we start out, let's find a little bit out about your background and about how you kind of came into the medical field. So tell me, where did you initially grow up at?
I originally am from Montana. My parents moved there for school. And I think very young, I moved to the Midwest. And that's where I really grew up, was in Iowa and Minnesota.
That's a lot different than growing up in were you in a big city or a small town kind of setting?
It was small towns, really.
So when you, what made you choose a career in medicine? Was there something that happened in your childhood or some path you were following, or were you good at certain subjects in school?
Yeah, I always kind of had a passion for science and biology and technology and, you know, medicine really encompasses all of those things and is kind of something that, you know, really people and humans, it's kind of the pinnacle of achievement and in all of those fields. So it kind of funneled me into medicine eventually.
Was there anything else that was happening in your youth that maybe you thought maybe a different career, you know, might happen at first?
My dad was a PhD scientist, and that's kind of where I was initially headed, I think.
Now, you attended medical school in Guadalajara in Mexico. What was that like? Well, of course, I guess you don't have a frame of reference from how the state schools are versus that, but tell me a little bit about that experience.
Sure. Yeah, it was, you know, wonderful education and life experience. They got us right into the clinics. They have a lot of Red Cross and Green Cross health clinics all over Mexico in small towns, and also an extensive public health care system. So we had the opportunity to work in all of those places really early in our education. So I think, you know, outstanding clinical experience and the school was quite good as well. And learned to speak a lot of Spanish along the way.
I can imagine you did. There are a lot of different specialities that doctors can go into, and some are just, you know, some are general medicine, and that neurology is something that it would seem like a very detailed and very in-depth in the study. What made you go for neurology?
You know, I worked in a laboratory after college for a couple years, and I was working with the interventional cardiologists. So cardiologists that treat heart disorders through the arteries and veins. And, you know, at the time I remember speaking with those interventional cardiologists, and they told me, you know, there are neurologists that do the same thing. So I kind of picked that early on and just kind of set my sights on it and went for it, you know. Neurology is also quite interesting because you really need to connect with the patient and hear their complete story of how the symptoms started and what the symptoms are like and things they may have been doing in their life at the time in order to come up with the diagnosis. So there's this real, story timeline you need to put together that narrows down our differential diagnosis for neurology. So I think those things really solidified my choice to become a neurologist and then a vascular neurologist and interventional neurologist.
When you're speaking with someone during the interview process, when you're getting to know them and you're talking to them and getting the timeline and everything with them, are there things that you can hear in the conversation that maybe they're not aware of that are triggering you to what might be going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think on two levels, you may have touched on something there, both, how their language is being formed by their brain. And how their mouth is working and to form the words, they can give you clues as to what might be going on for signs and symptoms of neurologic disease. And then, of course, there's the keywords and the red flag things that people say of how they describe their own symptoms that also can direct you to a neurologic diagnosis.
I think it's an absolutely amazing field, and I had not a friend of mine, but someone that when I went to school, he was sort of like a college parent, so to speak, and he was a neurologist, and I got to talk to him a lot. I just find it's a very fascinating field. What brought you to Peace Health?
I originally moved to Oregon following my brother, who had moved to Bend about 10 years ago as a fisheries biologist. And then my parents announced a couple years before their retirement that they're going to follow my brother to Bend because we know you're going to be moving a lot while you complete your training. So I was lucky enough to land a residency position in neurology at OHSU in Portland. And then, I wanted to stay in Oregon. I love the mountains and the ocean and rivers and forests that are here, being near my parents. And then as I looked for a job, I was recommended by a colleague to speak with Dr. Wilder, who's the other neurointerventionalist here at Peace Health. We seemed to get along really well. All the other people that I met in the neurology department seem to be great people that are easy to work with, and so that was exciting. And then one thing that I think really sealed it for me was how much support and growth I was seeing in the neurosciences department as a whole, in neurology and neurosurgery and the neuro part of intensive care, and our stroke program and treating these, really acute neurologic problems. I think all of those things, but especially the support of the neurosciences really sealed it for me that Peace Health was the place I wanted to be.
Well, you mentioned stroke there, and May is National Stroke Awareness Month. So we'll take a quick break right now, and we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about that. Speaking with Stuart Weber, he's an MD and on the neurology team at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center at Riverbend.
At some point in her life, one out of every eight women will get breast cancer. One out of eight. Most women can beat it, but only with early detection. Don't let breast cancer stop you. Mammograms save lives.
Better total care. Peace Harbor Imaging now has digital mammograms. Get one.
During uncertain times, the best way to stay healthy is to know the facts. Here are some ways we all can help stop the spread of COVID-19. Only leave your home for necessities. Wash your hands for at least 20 seconds. Call your doctor before going to the clinic or hospital if you're experiencing COVID-19 symptoms. At Peace Health, The safety and well-being of our patients, caregivers, and communities is our highest priority. We are all in this together. For more information, log on to peacehealth.org/COVID.
On the May edition of Doc Talk, I'm speaking with Stuart Weber. He's a doctor on the neurology team at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center at River Bend. And May being National Stroke Month, remind us, what exactly is a stroke?
Yeah, so strokes are when the blood supply to the brain is suddenly or severely reduced or blocked, which then prevents the brain tissue from getting adequate oxygen and nutrients. You know, the brain is it's a small part of our body, but it takes about 20% of the blood to keep the brain going. So it's high demand tissue. And so any blockage can quickly result in injury.
Does our American diet tend to push us more towards the commonality of stroke, or is this something a worldwide thing?
It's absolutely a worldwide problem. I think, you know, it's a combination of many things. Whether diet, you know, I think probably diets that are higher in fat and cholesterol pretend to higher stroke risk. There's some debate about salt and increasing your risk of cardiovascular disease, you know, smoking and sedentary lifestyle. So, you know, some of those things are associated with the American diet and lifestyle. So we do have a fairly high stroke rate, but similar to other countries like us, European countries and Canada and England and such.
Now, you didn't specifically mention stress, but I'm guessing that also plays a part in it.
Yeah, stress, you know, leads to high blood pressure, and high blood pressure is probably the biggest factor in your stroke risk.
Now, I don't know that I've ever had a stroke, but I've had a few incidents where I got foggy for a second, and I started doing the multiplication tables in my head to see if I could accurately come across them. Is that something, what are the signs and symptoms, and how can you recognize if you have a stroke or having a stroke?
Sure. Yeah. We use an acronym that's becoming more and more common, both, you know, for the lay person and medical professionals, such as paramedics and emergency medical technicians. We call it BFAST, and it really encompasses the most significant signs that we're looking for. So the B is for balance loss or imbalance, or, you know, someone may be walking and they keep veering off to the left or right. And so this real sense of, boy, I'm just not able to walk correctly because I feel like I'm going to fall. The E in B is for eyesight loss. So typically the sudden loss of vision. And that's actually can be fairly subtle. You know, patients aren't often aware that they've lost this vision. But again, some people describe not being able to all of a sudden see the side of the right side of the television if they're watching television, or they're notice that they're walking around and they're running into things on their left or right side, the side of the vision loss. So that can be a subtle finding, but something that typically stroke should be considered for. Facial drooping is a real common symptom of stroke. Most of the time, it's the lower part of the face, and it's most noticeable when people smile, but also can be noticed when people are drinking liquids, and all of a sudden, they're losing some of that liquid in their mouth out of the side of their mouth. That is a common way that this facial drooping is noticed. Arm weakness. You know, we do have arm weakness with most strokes. Again, it's this kind of sudden out of nowhere symptom. And sometimes you can't move the arm at all. It's completely dead. And others, it's just kind of more of a clumsy weakness. So a subtle weakness that all of a sudden, oh my gosh, my hand, I'm telling it to do something and it's doing it a little bit, but not like it typically does. Speech difficulty, it can be confused with others as confusion. So, you know, oftentimes, you know, we see these patients and the initial evaluation is, oh, the patient's confused. They must have taken, you know, some kind of drug or maybe confused their medications. But it's a speech that is often, we say, garbled or nonsensical. And they also at times have trouble understanding. And the last letter in BFAST is time to call 911, because it's that rapid activation of the emergency medical system and the stroke alert for the local hospital system that gets patients the quick treatment they need to reverse and reperfuse that starving brain. One other thing I think I'd like to mention at this point is that, you know, about 14 to 15% of strokes happen during sleep. Hmm. So waking up with these symptoms, you know, people don't witness this sudden onset that's so classic of stroke, but they wake up and they have trouble walking or these symptoms are present on waking up. So I think that's something that we don't hear a lot about, but is something that we need to be more aware of in general.
What happens different in the body that makes someone have a mild stroke to where someone might have a fatal stroke? What are the parameters there?
Sure. Yeah, it's really just the size of the clot, typically, because, you know, our arteries are much like a tree. They go up with these nice big carotid and vertebral arteries and branch into smaller and smaller arteries. So as you can imagine, a big clot is going to get stuck in one of the bigger arteries and block a much bigger area of brain, whereas a smaller one is going to go all the way into the smaller arteries and cause a smaller stroke. Now, sometimes small strokes can cause big symptoms if they hit a place in the brain that I like to call high value real estate, or where there's lots of nerve fibers running through there. And that's, of course, just unfortunately luck of the draw in those cases. So, you know, typically it's the big clots that cause big problems, but also the small clots can if they happen to land in the wrong place.
On a smaller, maybe a more milder stroke, are people more likely to be able to recoup 100% or 90% of this? What's kind of the rate that people can overcome the difficulties of a stroke?
Sure. Yeah. You know, overall, I think there's about a 20% mortality for patients having a stroke. So, you know, pretty high. And then there's varying degrees of recovery, like you said. But with a mild stroke, you know, and especially with younger people, so 50s, 60s, even 70s, they have a much better chance of having a full or nearly full recovery, returning to their, you know, old habits and driving again and such. You know, it's for a bigger stroke, of course, it's getting, you know, we start to worry about things like being able to care for themselves, needing, you know, long-term help for just activities of daily living and walking and returning to work.
Are you finding that due to the COVID pandemic that we're having, that are people more likely to delay their care if they think they might be having a stroke, or is that something that people are pretty much aware of and they get in right away?
You know, initially, I think when COVID hit, there was quite a dip in the number of admissions for strokes and the number of people that were getting the acute care that they needed. You know, maybe some of that is still lingering. I think people have kind of realized and become aware now that, and if they're not, they should be, that the hospital is a safe place, you know, much safer than most places out in the community. We take every precaution and, you know, mask wearing. Most of our employees are vaccinated. We keep people spaced far apart, and you know, hygiene is of the utmost importance here. So, you know, I think that message has gotten out there, but hopefully this interview will help us get that message to those who haven't heard it, that, you know, coming to the hospital with symptoms that are consistent with a stroke is so important, because we need to get you treatment as fast as we can, because as we say, time is brain.
Now, here in Florence, if someone has a stroke here in Florence, what treatment options are available here locally?
Yeah, so you guys have a great hospital there, and you guys have great EMS. I think the most important message is that calling 911 to get that stroke alert going is important. You know, a lot of people we see want to drive themselves to the emergency department or have someone else drive them to the emergency department because they think they'll get faster care and can get there faster than calling an ambulance. But it's really that component of the stroke alert setting every team into motion that gets them the fastest therapy. So when they get there to Peace Harbor, to the hospital, the emergency department physician will evaluate them, determine if they're having a stroke or not. And then typically they'll consult with someone from our neurology stroke department, review imaging and decide what treatment is needed at that time.
Now, speaking of treatments, have treatments changed much over the last couple of decades? Are we learning more about them now and how to treat them? And if so, what are some of the ways?
Sure, yeah. So for the last few decades, we've used something called TPA, which is a medication that breaks down the clot. It's an extremely powerful medication. And so we kind of have to balance its risks and benefits. You get the biggest benefit by getting it as fast as you can in something that we call the golden hour. So really every minute counts when getting that medication. As time lingers on, which is, you know, getting past 3 hours, it becomes less effective, probably because the clot has some time to kind of get settled in there and doesn't want to move, but also the risk of having bleeding from it goes up.
Now, what are some of the best ways to prevent a stroke?
Sure. Really modifying the reversible risk factors that we have. So blood pressure, you know, we call it the silent killer for a reason. You don't really feel that you have high blood pressure most of the time unless it's really high. And it does slow progressive damage to the arteries in all parts of our body, including the brain. So hypertension or high blood pressure is the most important reversible risk factor. There's also diabetes. So getting good treatment and getting your average blood sugar under a certain level is also an important modifiable risk factor. Tobacco use, extremely important to quit smoking. Smoking is again, very important modifiable risk factor. It causes atherosclerosis or cholesterol plaque to build up and cause blockages that can cause strokes, among other cardiovascular problems. And then high cholesterol. You know, diet's important, but a lot of high cholesterol also is based on your genetics, what you inherit from your parents. So having your cholesterol checked, and if you have the appropriate risk factors, being treated with the medication to lower that cholesterol is also important in stroke prevention.
All right. Dr. Stuart Weber is the MD and a neurology team member at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center at River Bend. And up next, we'll talk a little bit about aneurysms on this edition of Doc Talk.
At some point in her life, one out of every eight women will get breast cancer. One out of eight. Most women can beat it, but only with early detection. Don't let breast cancer stop you. Mammograms save lives.
Better total care. Peace Harbor Imaging now has digital mammograms. Get one.
During uncertain times, the best way to stay healthy is to know the facts. Here are some ways we all can help stop the spread of COVID-19. Only leave your home for necessities. Wash your hands for at least 20 seconds. Call your doctor before going to the clinic or hospital if you're experiencing COVID-19 symptoms. At Peace Health, the safety and well-being of our patients, caregivers, and communities is our highest priority. We are all in this together. For more information, log on to peacehealth.org/COVID.
On the May edition of Doc Talk, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Stuart Weber. He is a part of the neurology team at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center at River Bend. Now, Dr. Weber, let's talk a little bit about aneurysms. Tell me the difference between an aneurysm and a clot.
So an aneurysm is a defect in an artery. You can have aneurysms in really any artery in the body. Of course, being a neurologist, I'm focused on the aneurysms in the head and neck. And the ones that we really worry about are aneurysms that are inside the head, which we call cerebral aneurysms or intracranial aneurysms or brain aneurysms. They form a point of weakness in the aneurysm wall, and that weakness becomes a bulge and starts getting bigger and bigger. And when they get bigger, they become at increased risk for bleeding, something called a subarachnoid hemorrhage.
So when you have an aneurysm, I guess I'm confusing with a clot because I've heard of aneurysms that travel. That's not the case, though, is it? Or is it?
No, these are much like a balloon in, mm-hmm. in some ways, right? It's a weak point in the wall of an artery, and with the pressure, our blood pressure, that bulge becomes bigger and bigger, and that's what an aneurysm is.
Now, I've heard from certain people that you don't necessarily know that you have this going on. How are there any signs or symptoms that can kind of give you a clue that this might be happening?
Yeah, it's actually very interesting. They've done large population studies, and it's probably about 5 or 6%. Some people think maybe 7% have this in the general population. Most of the time, they're very small and pose really no risk at all. But it's when they get bigger that they start causing problems. And even as aneurysms grow and get bigger, they rarely produce symptoms. Occasionally, they can push on the nerves that control the eyes and for vision, the optic nerve, and cause visual problems. And rarely, they cause headaches. But typically, they're found incidentally. So when people get scans for something else, say a headache or a migraine headache, or they've had an accident and they hit their head and we're looking at the arteries to make sure that nothing's happened during the accident, that's how the aneurysms are found.
How are they treated? What's the treatment for that?
Yeah, so that's something that I really focus on for my specialty is we're able to treat a lot of these aneurysms through the arteries. So we go up through the arteries with small catheters, which are tiny tubes, and under a live X-ray, put the tips of those tiny catheters into the aneurysm and deploy little tiny platinum coils to cause an inflammatory reaction with the blood in the aneurysm, and it causes the blood to clot and seal off and form a scar and thereby cure the aneurysm. In the technology for treating aneurysms has really changed and improved over the last 10 years or so. Now we also have other small devices that are able to shunt the blood past the aneurysm so that it seals off and clots. Another one is putting this little mesh ball into the aneurysm, and that allows, again, the blood to clot and seal off the aneurysm. So these treatments have become safer and more effective and have resulted in the need for an open traditional surgery to decrease in numbers. We can treat most of these now through the arteries, and really it's just wonderful for the patients.
How often are they deadly?
That's why we are so concerned about these things when we find them. About 15 to 20% of people die if they were to rupture, and right there on the spot, essentially, or within a few hours. And then there's probably about a 30% chance of death overall from a ruptured aneurysm over the ensuing months, ensuing 3 months. So that's why it's important that if you have an aneurysm that's found, you see someone like me or someone else who treats these, to really monitor them and treat them if they're get up to a certain size, and that's when the risk of having this rupture increases significantly.
Well, I tell you, that's a lot of great information today, and I learned a lot too, and I like when I get to learn stuff, because I'm not a doctor, so it's always good to have you folks on here that do this. Dr. Stuart Weber is a doctor at the neurology department, our neurology team at Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center at River Bend. And Dr. Weber, thank you so much for hanging out with us today and giving us this great information.
Well, thanks for having me on, George. I really appreciate the opportunity to let people know what we do here and provide some information that hopefully gets them quick treatment if they or someone they love are having a stroke.
And as you mentioned earlier, we've learned so much about COVID now that we're doing a much better job of handling the situation, so people don't need to feel insecure about coming to the hospital when they have an emergency or a critical need. Dr. Stephen Weber is new with the neurology department at Peace Health Medical Center in River Bend, and it was a pleasure speaking with him for this edition of Doc Talk.
You have been listening to Doc Talk, presented by Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center. For more information on the program and services provided, visit peacehealth.org.